Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Maritime Museum. With Turning the Tide, the role of Manitowoc's landing craft tanks in World War II, an exhibit exploring Manitowoc's role in the war and D-Day. WisconsinMaritime.org.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Hey, it's the first Tuesday of the month, and we usually talk sports on that first Tuesday of every month. And today, we're going to start by talking with you about the sport of swimming. And a couple of guests for you. One, by phone, Katie Drusch, is the general manager of Swimtastic Swim School in Waukesha. Katie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you with us today. And also with me in the studio, Carl Milholland is the swim coach and owner of Swim Faster Madison. He's also the communications chair of Wisconsin Masters Swimming and Adult Competitive Swimming League. And Carl, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining in.
Great to be here and great to talk about swimming.
So we're going to talk about talk with Carl and Katie about learning to swim, maybe as an adult, plus how you can find everything from a pool to a swim club. And maybe you already participate in a swim club. What do you want to know about learning to swim? Do you have kids who maybe haven't taken up swimming yet and you want to get them involved in swimming? I hope you'll join in. Maybe give us your experiences so far, good or bad. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Carl, just start with you. How'd you get into swimming?
I started swimming when I was about 6 years old, jumping off piers in Twin Lakes in Wisconsin. And I've just been swimming ever since. I was a high school swimmer, went to the state meet way back when. Things have changed a little bit since then. And then I went to college. I went to the University of Hawaii. I was on the swim team there for a couple of years. Stuck around Hawaii, did a lot of body surfing, a lot of water activities, and just kind of kept swimming up. Moved back to the mainland. I've been here for a while, had some kids and things. And then once the kids grew up, I started getting back in the pool myself. And so about 2010, I started doing master swimming, which is basically a couple workouts a week. It's a good swim.
Yeah.
And then started getting into competitions with masters. And those are from 18 years old up to 100 years old. And we literally have people who are in their hundreds swimming, masters swimming.
That is absolutely amazing. Katie, what about you? What's your experience getting into swimming?
So when I was little, my mom got me lessons so that I'd learn how to doggy paddle, basically like save myself if I had to, and how to back float. But that was pretty much my experience with learning how to swim. One of the houses I lived in Arizona, we had a pool, and so, you know, just playing around in the pool with my siblings and friends. But it wasn't until I was an adult, probably about four and a half years ago, I started working at Swimtastic Swim School, and I had no experience teaching swimming, but their training program is great there. And so within learning how to teach swim, I learned how to swim all the strokes myself as well. And then I also picked that up as a way of exercise for myself, which has been amazing. I love how low impact it is, and anybody can do it. It's great because you can modify it for all abilities. And yeah, my kids have learned how to swim in the process as well. So it's been great.
Yeah, my own kids went through probably a similar kind of program here in Madison, just starting out pretty young, and now I have a daughter who is majoring in marine biology, was scuba diving in 70 feet of water off Grenada this past this past summer on a research project looking at the long-term project on coral reefs. So it's turned into a probably going to be a lifelong thing for her. It's what are the biggest benefits in your mind? Katie, you mentioned a couple of things, you know, but Carl, in your mind, what's the best thing about swimming?
Well, like Katie said, it's low impact. It's, you can do it for a long time. And once you learn proper technique, it's really easy on the body, whereas you're getting a good cardiovascular workout or just a little bit of fitness exercise periodically a couple times a week. And then if you want to get more involved in it, you can push it, or you can just sort of grab a pull buoy or something and just splash around. Just water, it's just a great tonic for anybody.
Julie in Oshkosh has a question, a procedural question kind of for you guys, I think. Julie, what's on your mind?
Hey, so I used to swim all the time, and I had my favorite pair of goggles, which were Barracudas. I have relatively close-set eyes, and they're a little bit deep-set as well. And to use a lot of regular goggles, I end up having to have them so tight that I end up with, you know, the huge rings. And I can't stand it when my goggles leak. So I was wondering what you would recommend. Wow. Barracudas I like, but they have so many different kinds. I don't know which is, you know, which would be good for my head shape.
Yeah. Carl, idea, and Kate, we can get you in too, Katie. But
yeah, I think your best bet is to find a good swim store. There's Ellsmore, there's one in Brookfield, and there's one in Brown Deer at the Schrader Pool. There's one here in Madison called Simply Swimming, and they have all types of goggles, so they will help you to fit the right goggle, because I know for myself that there's only one particular pair that I can wear. When you try them on, what you want to do is, before you strap them on, push it onto your eyes and see if you get a little bit of suction. That suction means it's fitting on your eyes and you're not going to get water in it. And then the strap should actually be a little loose. It shouldn't have to be super tight. It shouldn't hurt.
No. And then Katie, you're agreeing with that?
Yeah, that's great advice.
So, Julie, so is there a swim store in the Oshkosh area?
Up in Appleton, maybe. Otherwise, if you could repeat the names of those, I can look them up.
Yeah, it's Ellsmore, E-L-M-O-R-E. If you call the Oshkosh Y, they can maybe help you out. Oshkosh Y has some nice swim programs there. Yeah. And then they're Simply Swimming here in Madison, and they're great. Both of these organizations outfit pretty much every high school team and every swim club in the area. So they've got it all.
All right, Julie, there you go. Get you back into swimming. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Carl, you're a swim coach and owner of Swim Faster Wisconsin, as we said. How do you help people become better swimmers?
So I book, I have a sign-up sheets online. I book 45 one-on-one lessons. And this is everything from I'm afraid to put my face in the water to I want to get faster on my next triathlon. And so my philosophy is every swimmer is unique. So I always kind of look at where they're at, what their skills are, and then kind of triage what's the next thing that we need to fix. And so we just kind of go along the line. And then usually I'll book like 6-8 lessons for a couple weeks. And then the hopes is that after that time, you're getting better. And so prepping maybe for a race, or just being able to say, I can now swim continuously up and down the pool.
And Katie, what about you?
Yeah, so sorry, I just lost my train of thought. What was the question?
How do you work with swimmers? How do you help people become better swimmers? And you work a lot with youth, very young even.
Yeah, we start with 4 months all the way up through adult. We get a variety of people in for different reasons, whether they're wanting their children to learn how to self-rescue, how to be safe in and around the water, and or just looking how to prepare to be on like a swim team. So their kids are wanting to learn the strokes to be on a competitive swim team. We have a recreational swim team, and so that's a lot of fun for them. And then with the adults too, you know, like he was saying, they come in with all different stories and different backgrounds. Sometimes there was trauma. Sometimes there's like fear or anxiety around the water. So just meeting them where they're at and listening to them, learning what their goals are, and then creating a plan off of that with them, but taking it really step by step.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Jean in Merrill has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jean.
Hi, I have a question and a comment about swimming as physical therapy. A year and a half ago, I had an intermedullary rod and nail inserted in my femur. And despite a year of regular physical therapy with everything, including laser treatments and dry needling with electrification, those attachments on the hip, although I was restored to full functionality, I can run, I can walk, I can ride my horse, I found that now all I need to do 6 minutes every night, even last night, in our lake in northern Wisconsin, 59 degrees, 6 minutes of swimming at the frog kick does more than a year and a half of physical therapy. So people of a certain age who might want to use swimming specifically for that, how do they go through knowing or find someone that can help them with just the right kind of stretches, exercises in the water so that they can not have to go through all that physical therapy?
Go ahead, Carl.
So a lot of pools have aqua exercise, and it's gotten really popular. I know at the some of the pools I work at in the summer, I'll see 100 people doing aqua exercise. So water gives you some resistance, but it's not the same as lifting weights. So I can see how that would be very helpful because you're using your muscles, but you're not, you're kind of gauging how much stress you want to put on them. Whether it's just bouncing around in the water, and a lot of pools will have a like a belt you can put around to float. I know at the high school, sometimes the runners come in, they put that belt on and they run in place in the water. And so it's just another way to kind of get a real good low resistance exercise, working your muscles without putting too much stress on them.
Yeah. Katie, anything to add there?
I know that some of those programs where you go in for that physical therapy, they actually will meet you in a pool too. I know there's different programs out there that offer it. So you can actually probably, I would say after doing one or two sessions, that would, based off of my knowledge, really get you kind of going so you could take over on your own with exercises that you could do in a pool.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, once a month we have physical therapists on our program to talk about dealing with those aches and pains and so forth. And one of them, Lori Tyne Brody, works almost exclusively in the pool with her, with a broad range of clients, and has had magnificent results. The UW Hospitals and Clinics has its own pool for that work. So, Jean, thank you so much for joining in. I appreciate your comments. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Questions, comments, experiences to share relating to swimming, we'd love to hear from you. And our guest, Katie Drusch, general manager of Swimtastic Swim School in Waukesha, and Carl Milholland, swim coach, owner of Swim Faster Madison, and communications chair of Wisconsin Masters Swimming and an adult competitive swimming league. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking swimming today with Katie Drews, general manager of Swimtastic Swim School, and Carl Milholland, swim coach and owner of Swim Faster Madison. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Katie wanted to talk with you for a minute about safety. From a safety standpoint, why is it important to know how to swim at a basic level?
Yeah, so I think a lot of times the misconception is it's more important for kids to learn how to swim than adults, but it's just as important for adults to learn how to swim as well, because accidents do happen and you never know when you might find yourself in the water, even if you weren't planning on it. So definitely knowing how to swim is super important at all ages. Even if you're a parent, you know, and you never learned how to swim, you can learn at any point, at any time. It's never too late to learn. As a grandparent, you can learn so that not only can you get in the water and play with your kids in the water, but also if you did need to rescue them, that you, you know, would be able to if you needed to as well.
Yeah, and speaking of rescues, you've actually had some, you've saved a life, if I'm not mistaken, as well.
Yeah. So I have five children. They range in age from 17 all the way down to 4 and a half. And when my oldest was about 8 months old, we were at a hotel pool where there was not a lifeguard present. And there was other people swimming there. We were swimming there. And one of the kids noticed that there was a boy at the bottom of the pool and pointed it out, and I was the nearest person. So I dove down and brought him up to the surface. And when I stood up with him in my arms, I realized that he was lifeless. So I called out for them to call 911, got him to the side of the pool, and a hotel staff person came rushing in and started CPR. Thankfully, he was not under too long. And he came back to life. But I tell you, watching a body go from lifeless to back to life, I mean, it's like nothing you'd ever see. And it actually was a trauma for me. And within that trauma, it ignited my passion to teach, you know, for my kids to learn how to swim and to learn to be safe in the water, but also to get first aid and CPR certified as well. So after that happened, I actually went and got first aid and CPR certified so that if I had ever needed to help somebody that I would be able to. It ignited this passion in me, and I've learned so much about water safety and swimming and, you know, rescuing, and just got into the whole swim world as an instructor. I started off as an instructor to be able to get my kids actually into the lessons, because where I work at Swimtastic, one of the things that Michelle, the owner, has always offered is free swim lessons if you work one shift a week there. So I was like, hey, I got five kids. This is great. Like, you know, I can totally try this and see how good of a swim instructor I can be. Sure. You're going to train me. Great. So within a short amount of time, like, all of my kids, like, went through the program, and my youngest three are still swimming there. But by the time my little one, when I started, she was about 13 months. And by the time she was a little over two, she could come down the slide and swim across the pool. And she's been through different, like, self-rescue tests, as my other kids have as well. And just knowing that if she could save herself, that she could, even fully clothed. We're talking, she had an undershirt on, sweatshirt, sweatpants, socks, tennis shoes. She was able to get herself to the edge and pull herself out of the pool, and her clothes were heavy. You know, I think it's not only important for kids to learn how to rescue and, you know, how to swim in the water with their swim clothes on, but it's important to practice with regular clothes on, even a jacket, because when you get in the water with those items on, it's going to feel completely different. Even with goggles, some kids will think they can't swim if they don't have goggles on. So it's really important to practice without the goggles on, because if you needed to, then you want the kids to know, okay, I don't need goggles to be able to swim.
Well, all good points.
Good story.
Yeah, a great story. Thank you for that story. Chris in Toma has a different kind of question, so let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Well, hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a short story followed by a question at the end, but I grew up in Florida, and I grew up around the water, and by the time I was a teenager, I considered myself a fairly avid swimmer. Just put the goggles on, and there I go. I never had any problem swimming, and I moved to Wisconsin in 2007, and this past summer, some family came up from out of town. It was Mother's birthday, and so we all got together and rented a pontoon boat, and we went out on the Wisconsin River, and I hadn't been swimming in probably close to 15 or 20 years, so I was really looking forward to it. And so I'm telling everyone how excellent of a swimmer I am. And then when I jump in the water, I instantly realized that I was having a lot of trouble. I was able to resurface after I jumped off the boat. And I'm like, okay, this is a lot more work than I remember. And then so I kind of got my bearings. We were all having fun. And then I get caught by the current. And the current's pulling me downriver. And I can't swim against the current. I'm like, why can't I, swim like I used to? And so, long story short, they had to pull up the anchor and come get me, and they ended up throwing me a life preserver, because by the time they got to me, I was exhausted, and then they had to pull me up onto the boat, and I'm laying there, and so, talk about embarrassing, here I am telling everyone how excellent of a swimmer I am, and so I'm wondering, like, when we get older, can our bodies change? I mean, I've always been overweight, but is it possible when you get older that it becomes harder to swim?
So,
Carl, I'm going to go to you for
that. The shorter answer is you can swim until you can't swim anymore, which means you're prone.
You're dead.
You're underground. But, yeah, you're going to get older. I'm 71 years old. This summer I did 2 5K swims. One was in Lake Michigan against 4-foot waves. But you have to work up to it. So I like to teach that there are 3 factors in the human body in terms of swimming. One is biomechanical, and that's just how you use your body to move on top of and through the water. So that's the stroke mechanics and those kinds of things. The next one, though, is biochemical. That's how your body is processing the energy that's inside it and processing oxygen and eliminating carbon dioxide. That needs work. You can't just jump in the water and say, oh, I used to swim 15 years ago, because you need to build up to that. You need conditioning. And then the third factor is psychology. And this goes if you're in a swim meet to just finding yourself in a tricky situation where you're panicky. And the key to good swimming is relaxation. You watch a pool full of swimmers and you'll see that most of them are just moving in a relaxed method. And once you get past that, then you can just keep going.
Yeah. And Katie, what would you add to that?
Yeah, well, I would say that there is probably a few different things that could have been going on for you that day. Definitely the fact that you hadn't swam in a while, I'm sure contributed. But also the temperature of the water. When you jumped in, you were probably not expecting it to be as cold as it was. And when that hits your body, it can, induce a little bit of panic too. And then, with the current, like you said, the current was stronger than you thought. You never want to fight a current, because you will get very tired very quickly. And so what you want to do is just let it take you and swim to the side. You don't want to ever swim against a current, and get on your back. Definitely on your back is like, I teach the kids, like we teach the kids at our school, your back is your safe zone. You could hang out on your back a very, very long time. So as you get tired, roll over. Even if you're a good swimmer, everybody's going to reach that point where you're tired. Roll over on your back and rest. It helps you, too, to get your bearings of what's going on around you. Okay, where am I at? Where is the nearest place I can get to? As you're floating down the stream, okay, do I see a place where I can grab onto a branch? Is there a person? But just getting on your back allows you the time to sit and think.
I just want to add one thing, and that those currents also go for big lakes, Lake Michigan, with waves. Sometimes it's fun to jump around in the waves, but you can find yourself getting carried away. And what they teach you is don't fight that current. Go sideways. Go either left or right away from it and find calm water.
Makes a lot of sense. Chris, there you go. You conditioning and a whole lot more here, as our two experts have talked about today. I appreciate it. But you should get back in a pool maybe and get yourself.
That's right. The only way you're going to fix that problem.
Yep. That's the only way to fix that problem and get yourself conditioned. And Carl mentioned he'd put on some weight. Kurt called, couldn't stay with us. And Kurt says, or asked, is it true that real skinny people have a harder time swimming than people who have more fat? And there is something to that, I believe.
I have a peer of mine, and he's skin and bones, and I'm not. And so we have this constant argument. I go, well, you're nice and streamlined. You can go really fast. And he goes, yeah, but you got that body weight that gives you buoyancy. So I don't think that there's any particular body type that's more conducive in terms of body weight. But the only other thing is, I would say in colder water, if you're skinnier, you're probably going to notice that colder water than a guy like me who's got a permanent wetsuit.
Katie, a comment?
Totally agree.
Well, the human body is in water. Your human body floats because it's slightly less dense than water. And the upward force of buoyancy is greater than the downward force of gravity. So there you go. And so if you are a little heavier, you've got more air, let's say, in your body, and you're going to float a little easier than if you're really skinny.
I agree. One thing that I teach with a beginning adult who's maybe a little afraid of water is I'll get a weight. It's like a ring or something that sinks to the bottom. We go in about 4 feet of water. I put it down to the bottom, and I say, now go get that, right? Because mm-hmm. they think if I stop swimming, I'm going to sink. And I watch them struggle to get down to the bottom of the pool. And I said, you see, the body wants to stay up on top of the water. Now we have to learn how you control that.
Is that a method you've used, Katie, or do you use something different?
That's not really something that we do. We do have the kids, reach under the water to bring up a weighted object, like a very light weighted object. We call them sinkers. We also have rings. As we get more to like the recreational swim team side of it, you know, there's other items that we can put under the water that weigh a little bit more. But that's definitely, something that you can, you know, think about doing as well. But for them, it's more like learning that breath control, how to hold your breath underwater, get down and come back up.
Yeah. Sherry at Oshkosh emailed us, and Sherry wanted to underscore one point of the caller from Merrill, who swims just 6 minutes daily for rehab. The 59-degree water is likely as therapeutic as the swimming. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I can't really say, but yeah.
It makes some sense, though, for sure.
Yeah, it makes sense, but I don't have any evidence of that. Katie?
Yeah, our pool is like a warm 91 degrees. My expertise is not in that either.
Anne in Madison emailed us. Anne had an amazing experience in the spring when she went on a swim trip to Turkey.
Yeah.
They swam 5K each day for a week in beautiful, clear, sparkling sea waters. They have trips around the world and a year round. This is Anne. Anne wishes more people knew about it as an option for travel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's on my bucket list. Swim Trek is one of the better companies that do that.
But that sounds like, obviously, you got to be somebody who's fit and capable to swim 5K a day.
But they'll gauge, they might group you in with other people who maybe you who are going to be about the same speed and class as you.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And Debbie emailed us. Debbie has a response for the man who called in saying he grew up in Florida and couldn't swim in Wisconsin. He grew up swimming in salt water, which is more buoyant.
Yeah, there you go.
Then there's definitely some truth to that. So all good comments. What about you? Question or comment? You can email us to talk@WPR.org, or we'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Give a call or shoot us a note. Katie, you mentioned you have classes even for 4-month-old, and here's one other email from somebody who said, what good is it to have a 4-month-old in the pool? I mean, they're not going to learn how to swim, are they? Talk about that a little bit, Katie.
Yeah, so, you know, the earlier you can get kids in the water, the better. The sooner they, with that exposure to the water, a lot of times they're going to have these natural reflexes as babies. So they're going to naturally hold their breath. And, you know, we have different exercises that we do with them throughout the class. It's all very fun. It's all just geared as, you know, getting them comfortable, getting them used to the water. It's a fun bonding time with mom or dad. Even grandparents will bring the babies or the toddlers, which is so fun. But they really do learn, you know, and with the different activities we do and the repetition of the structure of the class, they are starting to learn that breath control and to learn that backflow. Just really gaining those skills at a lot younger age because of that exposure. And then also a lot of times when kids are older, even like if you bring in a 1.5 to a 2-year-old, sometimes if they've never been in the water before, it's going to take them a while to get comfortable. Whereas if you started with that 4-month-old and you're really getting them in the water, getting them comfortable, they're just going to remain comfortable in the water and just really be enjoying it a lot faster. And they're swimming a lot sooner. I've seen already where we have 4-month-olds that come in, and then we've got like an 8-month-old that comes in, and that 4-month-old is going to backfloat a lot sooner than that 8-month-old just because of that practice.
Interesting. And of course, you got mom or dad involved in those, but I noticed on your website that you encourage parents not to be visible. I mean, with a little bit older kids than that, it's better that they not be sitting there next to the pool watching the child. Is that and the reasoning on that, Katie?
Yeah. So if you've got a child that has never, a lot of times when they're coming in at that 2-year-old mark, they've never been in a class by themselves. They've not started gymnastics yet, or they've not started dance or, soccer, just those different things where they would do that on their own. So a lot of times this is their very first time leaving mom or dad. And even those kids that are in daycare or preschool, it's a different setting from being in a class like that. And so a lot of times, you know, what we'll say is see how they're doing. If they're having a hard time, we always welcome parents to come in and sit behind them, you know, so the child is on the stairs and they can sit just right at the very top of that stair, just behind them, so that they know that they're there. Some toddlers that works really well, and other toddlers, they are more upset by the mom or dad sitting there because now they're just focused on mom or dad. And then if they're on the other side of the glass sitting at the front, they, again, now we're just looking back at mom and dad instead of focusing on the swimming and what we're doing in the water. And so, you know, all kids are different. Some kids just come in like they've always been in swim class, and some kids come in and they take a few weeks to get comfortable.
You mentioned holding breath, and I read somewhere where the average person could hold their breath from 3 to 5 minutes underwater. How do you do any? Well, you obviously do some training on holding their breath, but I don't think I could hold my breath underwater for 5 minutes. I know that would take work. How does one train to do something like that? Carl, have you had any experience with that?
Yeah, I have. And I want to note right now that the Wisconsin Department of Health is having swimming pools post signs in their pool saying no breath holding, because there's something called shallow water blackout. And that's when kids have a contest on how long they can stay underwater. And there's a way to do it right, but it takes a professional to help you to go that. If you want to do like see how far deep you can go or how long, you need to work with somebody who knows how to teach you that. The problem with breath holding contests, you'll hyperventilate where you're moving air. And then while you're underwater, you're going to pass out. And so that's a big thing that the pools now are very vigilant about.
Well, that makes
like I say, if you want to stay underwater, find somebody who knows how to teach you that.
I think it's a process, is it not?
Yeah, it is a process.
Start slow or start low and work yourself up. And I don't know, Katie, have you taught any of that?
Yeah, so it is definitely a process that you want to take one step at a time. And, we start off with doing cup pours with our babies and with our toddler classes and that sort of thing, because you want them to feel that water come down their face, and just pouring a very little bit at a time and then pouring a little bit more as you watch how they're handling it. And then with bobs, with our bobs, it's, going underwater and coming back up, taking a breath, and then going back under. And you've got to do that in stages, because it takes time for them to learn that. And if they come up from being underwater, even if it's that very short time and they're sputtering on the water, okay, now we're backing it to the previous step because they weren't quite ready. And we don't want to have, and breath holding is very dangerous. Yes, it's not something I know that kids should ever be practicing or playing around with. I agree. Definitely always seek somebody that's skilled in that if you're needing to learn that for something.
Makes a lot of sense. Katie Drewsch, General Manager of Swimtastic Swim School in Waukesha. And Carl Milholland is swim coach and owner of Swim Faster Madison, also the communications chair of Wisconsin Masters Swimming, our guest today. Questions or comments or maybe an experience to share? Hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address is talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll be hearing about birds and birding with our guest, Bill Volkert, back with us. So we're looking forward to that. And tomorrow, we'll cover all kinds of wildlife with Jamie Nack and David Drake, and we'll talk peregrine falcons as well with them. Right now, though, we're on to swimming with our guest, Katie Drewsch of Swimtastic Swim School, and Carl Milholland. Swimtastic, by the way, is based in Waukesha, and Carl Milholland, based in Madison, Monona, swim and coach and instructor of Swim Faster Madison. So it's great to have both of them with us. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Here's an email question for you. What kinds of swimsuits do you recommend for people who are just starting out, or is there any reason to have any particular swimsuit when you're just starting out? And what about swim caps and goggles?
You definitely want goggles. Yeah. Just because you're in chlorinated water. Swim cap is somewhat optional. It just really keeps the hair in place. Most people do wear swim caps. And a swimsuit, you just want something that's tight-fitting. I mean, you could go from a Speedo or a jammer, or if you're a woman, just a good tight-fitting suit. Because what you don't want is that resistance that, say, like swim trunks that you'd wear to the beach. If you're just starting out, it doesn't really matter as long as it's not a hindrance. But once you want to start doing laps, you want to get something that's tailored towards swimming in the water.
And Katie, what about you? You're often working with very young children, swim caps, goggles, suits.
Yeah, so definitely you do not want to size up on the swimsuit. I think sometimes parents think, they're going to outgrow it so quickly like they do their clothes. You definitely want the suit to fit nice and snug, and they do stretch, and over time they will stretch a bit more, even for adults as well. So you want it to be a good, snug-fitting swimsuit. And I would say, brand-wise, it really doesn't matter. I mean, especially if you're just starting out, whatever you can find that is, like, a good fit and a good, discount, too. I know Amazon has a whole variety, as well as, like, the stores. You can find them this time of year. You're probably clearancing them out, so from the summer. So now would be a good time to try out some different kinds. But I definitely don't recommend, like, a two-piece suit, especially for children, or even, like, a rash guard. A lot of times parents will send the kids in, like, they're swimming outside, right? So they got, like, a long sleeve rash guard on for protection for them, and then we got the separate bottoms. And the suits still kind of, they'll rise up. So then while they're swimming, they're fixing the suit. And so a one-piece is great. If you want to do a rash guard, just do a one-piece rash guard where there's not these, like, separate pieces going on. Even the sleeves tend to be too long. So then it's like we're rolling the sleeves up, and it hinders the swimming. So I definitely agree a good suit does matter, but you don't need to spend a lot of money on it. And then for swim caps, it does help to keep the hair out of the face. Also for girls or for anybody that has longer hair, just pulling the hair back, whether you put it in a swim cap or, just pull it back somehow with like a ponytail or whatever, so it's not in the face. And goggles are crucial too for swimming. I agree, not only just because of the chlorine, but just because that really helps them with their comfort level of putting their face in the water.
I remember my one daughter had we had a lot of trouble getting the right goggles for her head. I don't know, it was a smaller head or some thinner head or something, and it was a lot of trial and error to get the right pair of goggles, and she was little enough that it was, you had to almost try them. Buy one, try it. Oh, that one doesn't work. Let's try another one. So there was a lot of expensive trial and error going on. Katie, do you find that with parents?
Yeah. I mean, I love Carl's suggestion to go to some of the local places to try out the different ones and to get some help with fit. But with the kids, generally there are certain brands and certain styles that will fit better than others. You've got your A3s and your tier. Those are probably about the most popular ones for us with kids. Even with adults, a lot of times the adults that have smaller faces and things of that nature can get away with using the kids' goggles just fine. And so definitely just trying on, and we have that too, where the kids will try them on. But generally, it's not as hard, I don't feel like, for kids to find a good fit in a goggle as the adults are. But I recommend you don't go necessarily with like a really cheap brand of a goggle, because you will probably struggle more with the fit and the suction versus, just spending a couple more dollars to get, like a tier or an A3 or, a sporty, just those different ones that will fit better.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Margaret in Mosinee has a question. Margaret, hi. Margaret, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
I go to a swim pool in Mosinee that is shared by the community and the high school or middle school. And they want the swimming temperature water, the pool water, to be like around 81 degrees or something. And those of us who are elderly and do shallow water aerobics find it very, very chilly. I just wonder if you think that there's an optimum temperature for elderly people to get benefits from water aerobics.
Mm. That's a challenge with pools that are catering to all kinds of things. I know that for myself, I'm not going to do a workout if it's 88 degrees. That's like running in 100 degree weather. It just exhausts you. There's no real solution other than that maybe find a wetsuit or something like that that can maybe help keep that heat in a little bit.
Yeah, that would be one example. Katie, anything from your end?
I would look more for a pool in your area that, even if it's like a swim school, some of the swim schools offer open swim during the day where people can come in and do some aerobics or swim some laps. And that's a really good idea because you're going to find a warmer temperature in a pool like that. Whereas, like, you know, in the other type of pool, the kids are, you know, swimming, like, continuous. And so, you know, you don't want the water too warm. But with us, too, there's no acclimating, right? Like, with us having that water at 91 degrees, there's no child that's going to come in and, okay, now we got to get used to the water before we can actually swim. So I would say find a place that's going to have the water temperature, you know, more so what you're looking for, which I would say is probably around 88 to 90 degrees.
Yeah. All right.
Some of the bigger health clubs have different pools. And so they might have a warm water pool. I know there's a couple here in the Madison area. So they'll have a lap pool for people who want to do that. But then if there's like aerobics or those things, it's a different pool, different temperature. So look for that.
Yeah, that's another idea. Margaret, there you go. Thank you for calling. Brenda emailed us and asks, can you talk about skin and hair care pre and post swim in fresh or the chlorine?
Yeah, I would say definitely rinsing before you get in. There are products that you can get for your hair and your body that you can put on first before you get in the water, and then making sure you rinse off right away afterwards. And they sell a whole different, I mean, there's so many different products you can get for that, but different people react differently to the water too. So some people are actually like allergic to the chlorine in the pool or other things like that. And so there's a lot of stuff out there that you can find to help with that as well.
Now, where would you go? Would you go to the swim place to learn about those things, or
you could go to the swim place, or you could get it online?
Amazon.
Go ahead.
Right. Yeah, I would say definitely you could Google just to kind of like look up some different products and things of that to see, you know, what kind of meets your needs. And if you go on Amazon, you're going to be able to read reviews too. And people give different examples of, okay, I've had this problem with it and this product really helped me, which I think is also great.
We got two people in just the last minute here, Katie Ledecky and Michael Phelps. Why are they so good, or were they so good, or have been so good? I mean, they're both world champions.
Michael Phelps just had an incredible body for swimming. I mean, he could scratch his knees without bending over.
Yeah.
And he had a wingspan that was, when he stretched his arms out, it was wider than he was tall. And so he just had pretty much the perfect body, but he also had a heart. And he just really, when he was very young, he set a goal, and that was to swim in the Olympics. And he made that goal. Phelps is a great story. Katie Ledecky is a machine, right? You look at her physical attributes, and she doesn't look like your typical swimmer. But she's just got endurance like nobody's business. She really is. She's just got these attributes. There's only one other swimmer I can think of who was about 20 years before her, and damn, the name is escaping me. She just, you know, she just moves.
She just moves.
Yeah.
Katie and Carl, thank you both so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it. Katie Drewsch is general manager of Swimtastic Swim School in Waukesha, and Carl Milholland, swim coach and owner of Swim Faster Madison. And they're both online, and I think we have a link on our page, but you can go online and take a look at what they've got. I like both of their pages very much. I'm Larry Mueller. Coming up, we'll take a look at birds and birding. Taking a look at fall bird migration on the program right now. Thanks for joining us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bill Volker. He is a retired wildlife educator, naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh State Wildlife Area for 27 years and has been watching birds for 50 years and has sighted more than 3,900 species of birds. And so he knows a lot. You've been listening for a while, you may have heard him in the past. He does a wonderful job. And as you listen, I hope you'll join in. Which birds have you noticed in the process of migrating, for example? Have some left your area for the year? Or let us know which birds you need help identifying. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or email to talk@wpr.org. And Bill, great to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Larry. It's always a pleasure to be here.
So, what birds have you been seeing recently?
Well, the songbirds are really on the move, and we're starting to see a bit of a changeover in the last few weeks, where the summer local birds were flocking up. We started to see some movements of birds coming down from up north. And at this point, quite a few of them have departed and essentially been replaced with some of the later migrants. So this is a really good time of that transition as birds are moving through in sequence.
Yeah. What are your favorite places to bird watch?
Well, probably my most
favorite.
In the fall. My most favorite is right in my own backyard.
Yeah.
It's very convenient. I live in the Northern Kettle Moraine, so that's a good place to keep a watch on. And over to the Lake Michigan is certainly a great spot for a migratory corridor. And, of course, picking up some of the birds out on the open water. Horicon Marsh, where I worked for so many years, is a major stopover for an awful lot of birds. And, you can go almost anywhere within Wisconsin and find a good spot where birds are both nesting in summer and stopping over at this time of the year.
Yeah, just was in the La Crosse area a few weeks back, and that Mississippi River is...
It's a highway.
It is a highway indeed, and I was up there one fall for some bird watching on the river, and it was unbelievable. The thousands and thousands of birds that were out there on the water.
Yeah, if you can get to some of these places at the right time of the year, you can find some very large flocks. I came across Horicon Marsh on my way down this morning, and lots of ducks were out feeding in the water there. And these are birds that are stopping over at this point. So when we're talking migration, we will have that preparation for migration where the local birds are done raising the young. They'll start to flock and gather. And then also now when birds are in transit, the birds will be coming down to your locale, and then they'll rest for a while, feed and flock. So when we think about actual migration, we usually don't see most of the birds really flying in migration. We see them more stopping over and gathering in flocks to refuel and rest, because most of the migration, especially for songbirds, takes place at night.
Yeah.
So you don't see that. And even for large birds like Canada geese and cranes, there's a lot of movement, but this is oftentimes when they've settled down. And the actual migration, the birds are just way up there, and it'd be something that you would see for less than 1 minute as they're passing overhead. So I had always told people, if you're looking at Canada geese, if you see them flying from 1 to 500 feet up, those are local feeding flights. They're just going from where they rested during the day out to feed and then come back again for the evening. In migration, they'll be up 2 to 5,000 feet, and we've seen them over 10,000 feet, and they're looking for favorable winds. So these birds are going to be way up there. If you see a flock of birds heading south with a good wind and up against the clouds, that's true migration.
And you call it one of the greatest phenomena among the animal world.
To me, it certainly is. This coming and going of massive numbers of birds as they travel with the seasons. Just the journeys that some of these birds make is just amazing. For anybody who spends time in nature, it is just a wonderful way to gauge the changing seasons as the different birds arrive and as they leave again. And the fact that some of these birds are making incredible flights, especially among the sandpipers, they're making flights of 8,000 to 10,000 miles each way. And with recent technology that we've been able to employ for studying birds and some of the new information that we're gathering, we're realizing that some of these birds are capable of making some of these flights almost nonstop.
That is absolutely amazing to me. And there's been so much research on migration and birds, but what don't we know about migration? In other words, are there some mysteries that still remain there?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's what makes it so interesting is that we know more today than ever, of course, but there's still a lot of things that we don't understand. A couple of things that have been recently revealed among bird populations is that not only do birds go back to the same place, of course, where there's nesting in summer, but also in wintertime. But what we've also found is that for large populations of birds that, say, nest across the eastern United States, and I was working with some people who did studies on wood thrushes, and what they found there is that wood thrushes from Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Quebec are going down to northern Nicaragua. The birds from the of Illinois, Wisconsin, Tennessee, they're going down to Belize. The ones from New England are going to Costa Rica. So they're not just going south, but distinctive regional populations are going down to very distinctive regions. And so we think this probably holds true for a lot of birds, but certainly not all. There's always exceptions. The other mystery is for shorebirds, for example, the adults depart from the nesting ground before the young. And somehow they know where to go. They're, in a sense, almost born with a knowledge and a map. And we are also understand more and more about bird navigation. We know some of the environmental cues that they rely on. So in order to get from point A to point B and do so unerringly year after year throughout the life of that bird, we certainly know that they are looking for favorable winds. And so last night we had a nice north wind come through, a little gusty, I think, for some songbirds. But that's what you want is a nice boost and a push to move you south. So you get a north wind behind you. You're going generally in the right direction. You mentioned the Mississippi River, the birds that are moving there. They're using the geographical features. So the north-south features, the Atlantic coast, Pacific, the Rocky Mountain Range, Mississippi, even the Lake Michigan shoreline, these are all geographical features. Flying at night, it was discovered back in the 1970s that birds use stellar navigation. Problem is when the clouds roll in, what happens there when they can't see the stars? What's the fallback system there? And we think there's multiple cues, of course, they're using. We also know that some birds are very sensitive to electromagnetic fields. And this was a study done back in the 50s. They took homing pigeons from New York, traveled down to Virginia, and they'd never been there before. Before releasing them, they put a little bit of a magnet on the tops of the heads of some of the pigeons, and to make sure it wasn't just having weight on your head, they put brass plates on the others. The guys with the brass plates made it home. The others apparently were just circling around out there for forever, so this seemed to interfere with navigation. Another interesting phenomenon for Wisconsin birds is, you know, we've been reintroducing the whooping cranes into Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And they actually have learning involved in the migration. So the parents have to teach the young, which is why Operation Migration, the ultralight airplane, was a substitute to show the first ones the route. All you got to do is teach them to go south, and they seem to remember where to come back coming north. But we did have a few birds that were, of course, we know the individuals since they're tagged.
Yeah.
They got off course, and one showed up in South Dakota, one Michigan, one in Connecticut. But interestingly, they're all at the same latitude. They knew how far north to go, and perhaps that's electromagnetic fields there, but had to learn the actual route to get back to central Wisconsin. So probably also other birds among the different families of birds rely on different cues, have different habits. They don't all do the same thing in terms of how they get from place to place. They've all learned it or are instinctively born with some other skills. But unerringly, they all migrate one way or another. And we're trying to figure out just how some of them do it. What are the exceptions and what are some unique traits? And it just is endless study. And it's just, as I say, a continuing mystery, but it's just fun to watch. And people have been doing it for thousands of years.
Dan, who's near Hayward, has a question for you. Let's go there.
Yeah, please.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, how you doing? I got a question. It's not so much about the migration, but I got blue jays that are just tearing up my apple trees, and I don't know what to do about it. Any suggestions?
So
they're hitting the fruit?
Are they eating the fruit? Is that it, Dan?
Yeah, I went out of town about 3 weeks ago for 2 days. I had a crab apple tree that had probably several hundred apples on it, and I came home and it was completely cleaned out like somebody plucked them. It was amazing. And I don't know how to keep these birds out of my trees. They just come in and they just destroy them and they leave. They come in the morning in flocks. Mm-hmm. Blue jays.
Blue jays do. That's an unusual diet for a blue jay, but they're such a generalist. Almost anything's on the menu for them. As we get into wintertime, those fruits that remain, robins and cedar waxwings will commonly take the dried up crab apples. That's a common food. This is unusual for blue jays. I suppose about the only thing you do is sort of the scarecrow thing, one way or another, deter them. But you've got to be as persistent as the birds themselves. And, you know, it's just like a bird that's tapping on the windows that's mm-hmm. seeing its shadow. You can get out in the morning, you try to distract it, and you have to go to work all day. Well, you know, the birds have just got this whole day then for developing bad habits. That's a difficult one, and I'm sorry, I really can't offer a good solution except some sort of deterrent and some, if you can find some way to scare them away, to be as persistent as the birds.
Yeah.
But, of course, they're protected under the federal laws, so you cannot harm the birds themselves.
No. Netting, maybe, if you've got small
You can try
trees.
Netting. Yes, there is fruit netting that does work. Of course, trying to put it over the whole tree is one thing. The problem I have with that is oftentimes birds get tangled in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't want to create a bit of a death trap just to try to prohibit the birds from having access.
Mm-hmm. Dan, there you go. Thank you for calling. Judy in central Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'm wondering about the kind of birds that I saw yesterday evening around 6 o'clock, and they were in two elm trees, and they were obviously all gathered there for a migration because they were all talking to each other, and the tree was just full. And they were – I didn't see them, although they did fly from one tree to the other. I'm just wondering what sort of bird might be.
Well, this time of year, probably a large list of things. The blackbirds, both red-winged blackbird and grackles, are gathering in some large flocks right now.
Yeah.
Cedar waxwings is another one that's flocking in pretty good numbers. And some of these birds can be extremely vocal. The blackbirds won't migrate till much later in the year, so what you're really seeing is coming into an evening roost site after scattering across the countryside and feeding for the day. At some later point in the year, those birds will take off with the north winds. Waxwings, they can even remain through the wintertime if there's food. But, yeah, as far as which bird, you know, it's a lot of them that have a similar habit. Like
yeah,
roosting
especially
in
if
evening.
We don't, yeah, especially if we don't have an idea of what they look like.
Yeah. Some birds tend to be a little bit more solitary in their habits. So quite a few of the songbirds do not gather in trees like that in extreme large numbers. But I would say the blackbirds, probably blackbirds, grackles,
one of those
the
two.
Most likely ones that are extremely visible.
Yeah, I would think so. Judy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, our guest, talking birds and birding with him, and I hope you'll join in. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking birds and birding on the show today with our guest, Bill Volkert, a retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Always great to have Bill come by. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Jeff in Berry Mills has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. I just wanted to throw in a little aside in here that right before your program came on, the National Weather Service in La Crosse posted a picture of on their radar of at sunrise this morning, several large flocks of birds taking off from southern Minnesota and northern Iowa. Pretty cool.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, one of the things when they developed Doppler radar was that they kept getting this backscatter at certain times of the year and signals when all the other predictive models were saying that there was no precipitation. And they weren't quite sure what it was, the interference. And finally, I realized that this was the migration of birds. And so Doppler radar has become a nice way of tracking migration. And as we mentioned earlier, we had a cold front come through last night.
Yeah.
And with that, the wind shifted out of the north. I think most people felt that. And to me, it seemed a little gusty down by the house. But as you get up a couple hundred feet, you know, if you have nice steady winds, those are the ideal conditions for bird migration. And radar certainly does reveal to us that we can have these movements of tens of thousands of birds. We don't know what kind they are from the radar, but we get an idea of just general density, which they can kind of extrapolate into rough numbers of birds that are flying. And yeah, you get these massive movements. The other thing they're doing is they're using microphones, pointing those up to the sky. And with the computer capability, using that, just like your Merlin app, to identify mm-hmm. the call notes of the birds going over. So, in other words, radar will tell us that we've got large numbers of birds and some relative numbers of what's going on up there. And then with the microphones, we get an idea of who's making up those flocks and flying through. And again, all this new technology is giving us insights into birds and bird migration in a way like never before. And some of the findings that we have are just within the last 5-10 years, and it just keeps evolving.
Randy in La Crosse will give you a chance. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to talk about, I grew up in Minnesota, and there's the Sherburne Wildlife Area mm-hmm. in kind of central Minnesota along towards the river. And sandhill cranes gather there every fall, like huge numbers of them. And those cranes, when they gather, or after they've gathered, then they migrate and they go to a big lake in Nebraska, which I've been to also, and that's even more amazing. But there's another group that gathers near Grantsburg. Mm-hmm. And from what I've been able to hear, or from what I tried to look into it, those birds go to Florida.
Correct.
The birds in Minnesota end up going to Texas. And I'm like, these gathering places are so close together. How do they separate that? How do they keep track of it?
Good question. Well, we talked earlier that the cranes are teaching their young. So cranes do not begin to nest or select a mate until they're at least 4 years old. So there is that period where they're non-breeders, and Canada geese also 2 to 3 years old before they start to nest. So the first year they're following their parents to the wintering grounds, follow them back up, and then they just sort of hang out as non-breeders. They'll join back in on those large flocks, and from that, they're learning that whole route and teaching their young. Now, the reason for the difference in the cranes is that you're looking at two different populations. The ones that are going to Nebraska and then down toward Texas are a little bit smaller. That's the lesser sandhill crane. It's a different subspecies. And here in Wisconsin, the upper Midwest, Michigan, this is the greater sandhill crane. Yeah, they're going down toward Georgia, North Florida. And we also have birds, depending on mild winters, may only go to Kentucky, Tennessee, southern Illinois. So wherever they need to go. So tradition takes them much farther south. And some of the birds always go to those wintering grounds. Others will just go as far as they have to. And we see the same thing with Canada geese, where the first migrants always arrive about mid-September. They're coming down from Hudson Bay, James Bay. They come into central Wisconsin. And yet we don't reach peak until mid to late October, when we finally get the first snow and ice in Canada, when they're forced off of those summer grounds. So there's some of them that seem to go by a signal of the shortening day length and anticipate migrations coming up. And we don't know if it's always the same ones, if that's passed on, if it's genetic or learned, and yet others will delay as long as they can. And then the same thing, where some of them will always go to the traditional wintering ground, continue all the way south, and others will linger until the snow accumulation forces them to go a little farther. So there's a little bit of different habit among the very same flock of either cranes or Canada geese.
Peggy in Black Earth will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Peggy.
Hi. My question is this. I heard you mention that some cedar waxwings will stay through the winter. Mm-hmm. We live on hardwood acreage in the woods, and I'm wondering, is there something I can put out to encourage them to stay around for food?
Oh, yes. Well, the cedar waxwings, they're catching insects during the summertime. You'll see them along lake shores and rivers in particular, hawking the insects, so flying up from a perch and grabbing them out of the air. And as we get into fall and winter, they're shifting their diet over to berries. And so berries is a big part of their winter food. And so the crab apples and other wild berries are a major food source for them. And it depends if we get a good berry-producing crop in a single year and how long that persists. So in wintertime, they become nomads. They move around wherever they can find that food. We pick flocks of cedar waxwings up on Christmas bird counts in Wisconsin every year. The numbers depends a little bit. It seems that as that food dwindles, as we get into that mid-late winter, they start to move further south. And then we see the return of them again coming back in May.
In May. There you go, Peggy. Thank you. So she has some crabapple trees or some berries?
Exactly. Fruit trees would be the main thing. Something with medium-sized fruit would be the best thing to provide for them. One of the problems that we find is that for birds that are eating a lot of berries, the invasive buckthorn is a real problem because their digestive system doesn't handle it real well. So here, it looks like a good food source for them, but what we found is that for some of these birds, it's actually a diuretic, and so that with that, they're actually the food's running through them very quickly, and now at this time of year when they should be gaining weight, they're not doing so. And so there's another problem with these invasives, with the non-natives, is that simply that our insects that depend on those plants and even the birds that do are just not adapted because it's basically a completely foreign type of plant for them, and they just have never adapted well to it.
Yeah, Peggy, thank you. To go along with that, Colleen from New Holstein emailed. Mm-hmm. She actually takes her bird feeders down on Father's Day because there's plenty of food around for the birds. But when should she put her bird seed feeders up? Are there specific telltale signs to look for before hanging them?
Oh, whenever you have time and have interest. We've mentioned this in the past that even in most winter times, we find that birds that come to feeders are still getting the vast majority of their food from the wild. It's just a convenience for them. So we're really feeding birds more for ourselves than we are for them. No doubt if we get a severe winter storm, it can be a lifeline for some of those birds. You can feed year-round, as the person had mentioned here. Yeah, summertime, there's so much food, it's hard to attract them necessarily. But I feed during the summertime. It's enjoyable to see the young coming to the feeders. Of course, during that time, you've just got to clean the feeders and change the food more often because you can have spoilage, and that's always important for it. There's also been a myth of keeping hummingbird feeders up too late, that we keep the hummingbirds here, that they won't migrate if we keep the feeders out. That's not true. They'll know when to go on their own, whether there's food or not. In fact, it may be the food that they need, right, as this time of year, as flowers are becoming less common and the food supply is starting to dwindle for those that have lingered.
And speaking of hummingbirds, Jeffrey in Green Lake's got something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hello. Hi. I was wondering if your guest has ever heard or seen a pure white hummingbird.
I have seen pictures of them. The albino can show up in most any kind of animal and bird. There are obviously some of the birds that show that much more commonly. Either partial albinism or just a few of the feathers or the head or something is going to be white, where they have that piebald mixed color, or pure white, total albino, where they just have no pigments. It's obviously a rare genetic, not mutation, but a combination for them. It can show up in small numbers in any population. But hummingbirds, I've seen a few photos of it. It's certainly extremely rare out there and very unique, no doubt.
Yeah. Jeffrey, did you see one?
My daughter did just outside her apartment in Green Lake, and she took a video of it.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, that is a rare sight.
Yeah, very rare. Thanks for sharing that, Jeffrey.
Appreciate
it. Daryl in Bangor, we'll go to you now. Hi, Daryl.
Well, good morning, Larry. How are you today?
Just doing great. What's on your mind?
Well, I was amazed at your topic because each year at about this time, I listen or I check on the Raptor Resource Project, and it has the Mississippi River Flyway Cam, where you can watch the birds right on the Mississippi, and I have my computer screen up right now, and it's just, it's amazing the different kinds of birds that you see. My question is, it just seems like pelicans, there's so many more pelicans than I remember growing up, and is that just, we're just lucky, or what's happening with the pelicans?
Well, there's actually been an eastward shift in the pelican population. And it started back in the mid to late 90s. There was a kind of the result of an extended drought in these central prairie states where most of the pelicans actually nest. And there was a very large colony of some 30,000 birds out on Chase Lake. And they were pretty isolated, no shallow wetland areas, except for when the drought came, the coyotes had access to it. So that became a pretty dangerous situation, and those birds began to abandon some of those sites, and we started seeing them setting up a little bit further to the east. And we had the first nesting in Wisconsin in 1996, and then little by little, we had nesting colonies that were becoming established. Pelican is another one of these very long-lived birds where the young birds will not begin to mate until they're probably around 5 or 6 years old. So you'll oftentimes see some large flocks in summertime of just these non-breeders gathered out there roosting and fishing on some of the lakes. And then you'll have the nesting colonies punctuated across the state. And for the last about 20 years, they've been well established here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, very, really interesting. Daryl, thank you so much for calling. Greg in Hazelhurst says they've seen a pair of red-headed woodpeckers on their property for 5 years, usually stay until late fall or early winter, and sometimes stay through the winter.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, this last summer, they disappeared. And wonders what happens. Did they lose their food source? Or, I mean, 5 years for a red-headed woodpecker.
Well, the red-headed woodpecker population across most of the state in general is quite low.
Yes.
So you do hear reports in the eastern and in the north-central part of the Wisconsin. The western and southwest part of the state is really the stronghold where we still have a fairly stable population. So people in these outlying areas will have a pair or two reported here and there. And I wonder if perhaps something happened to one of the pair or even both of them and essentially lost the entire local population because there was just, you know, that one pair that was nesting in the area. I guess the only thing to do is watch for next year, see if something shows up. If they have been successful in raising young over those 5 years, perhaps some of those young might have a tradition and come back again. You know, there's always that turnover among the population, too. A lot of these birds are living just 3-5 years, 7 to 8 years maybe. For a lot of the smaller birds, living 10 to 12 years is probably extended. Anything over 12 years is like you and I living over 100.
Yeah.
Maybe you'd want to, but it's not going to happen for most of us.
So
with that, you have this turnover, and as we're watching birds, you need to have a pretty stable population that's recruiting or reproducing young to take and replace those birds as they disappear. And when they start to get smaller in numbers like that, when it's one of your only pair in the neighborhood, if they disappear, you may not have something to draw from to be able to take their place.
Mm-hmm.
But keep watching. We'll see what happens.
See what happens. And the caller before had mentioned raptors, and tomorrow on the show, I just wanted to mention Greg Septim will be with us. You know, he founded the Wisconsin Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project, and so, you know, he's been doing that for 27 years, and it'll be fun to talk with him about peregrine falcon.
I do say hi. I haven't seen him in quite a while, but I've known Greg for many years.
Yeah, a great guy. You can join in, too. Questions, give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Wanted to highlight a few birds today on the show. One of them, the catbird. We have a few bird songs and calls to play, and the first is the gray catbird. And here's, let's play that song. Mm-hmm.
That's the summer song. He's a very chatty bird. It's that back and forth. It's just may go on for 15, 20 seconds. And he'll throw occasionally in that little meow. And that's the really the call note that we're hearing more this time of year. And this is a bird that loves the thickets. They'll nest in the heavy shrubbery, just like cardinals. So especially right now, they may be feeding on the berries of the bushes. They'll be hiding in those shrubs, and they're more easily heard. And I've got them around my property. I can hear them in the thickets and in the shrubs with that little meow call. And another interesting call I only hear at this time of year, and I think it's perhaps the young ones, to me it sounds like Jerry. Everybody tries to put their own little verse or phrasing to remember the bird calls. But it is interesting that it tends to be more in late summer and fall that I hear that particular call only.
Hmm.
But that's a bird that is fairly vocal, and they'll be departing within the next couple of weeks, heading down toward mostly into Mexico and the central part of Central America.
Another bird we're featuring today is the white-throated sparrow. And
Old Sam Peabody, 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 or Oh Sweet Canada, Canada, Canada. That's a little mnemonic, yeah. Remember. It's that high, thin whistle, and you will occasionally hear some of the birds producing that song in the fall time. Otherwise, it's just a single, real sharp chip note. This is another bird that loves the undergrowth and the brush and thickets, nesting in northern Wisconsin and southern Canada in the bogs, and now coming through, and they may be anywhere where there's some undergrowth and some heavy shrubs and cover. And interesting that the birds are not mating at this time of year, but you'll occasionally hear them produce a song. A couple of thoughts on that. One is that you are seeing a lot of physiological changes in the birds for migration, and these are hormone changes for the birds. They're molting their feathers. They're accumulating fat. They're getting into what is called a pre-migratory restlessness. They're just getting jumpy and ready to go. They know that they've got to be heading out. There's some actual physiological changes going on, and perhaps that same hormone change is also producing a song occasionally, which they won't need until spring. The other thought is these could be young ones that are practicing that song. They've heard it in the summer. They're going to try that little bit, make sure they get it right, so that next year they'll have a song and a chance for a mate. They also took white-throated sparrows years ago and captured them, kept them in a laboratory, took them out of the nest when they were very young to try to understand about song development. And what they found was they have the physical ability to produce the voice, but they have to learn the specific song. And so they refine that. Then this is perhaps that communication between each other. How am I doing? You know, how am I sounding? Trying and practicing a bit. And that's why, as you go across the country, for some birds that have very large, widespread populations like song sparrows, they sing differently in different parts of the country. There are actual dialects. Because they're learning a little bit of a different song from the others in the neighborhood.
That is amazing. Warblers, according to the Cornell Lab website, the yellow-rumped warbler can be found almost anywhere on the North American continent. Let's listen to that call. Lee's got it.
This is the call note. Because this time of year, they're not going to be singing. And it's a bird that I can pick out by its call very easily. It's somehow, I learned that many years ago, and it just catches my ear. It's not a sharp chip like a sparrow would be. It's not, we would describe perhaps as metallic like a cardinal. It's a little more sputtered. And it's hard to define, really. But if you listen to it enough, it's very distinct, very characteristic. And there is that difference between songs and calls.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, song is what the males are producing in springtime when they're establishing a territory to keep other males out and to lure a mate. And that's usually the more complicated, more complex vocalization. Calls are given throughout the year. And they may be when birds are flying overhead in migration, contact calls. It may be for food, if they're finding food source. Some birds, especially birds that tend to flock more, rely on each other. A lot more communication. So birds like chickadees and blue jays have just a very large vocabulary, and we'll hear a variety of different calls among them. And, of course, there's also calls for danger. So when they see predators, I remember one year I could actually hear birds with that real sharp little call note that they're making for predator. It really caught my ear, and it was kind of going across the forest. I heard 3-4 birds that were giving it one after another from different areas. And as I glanced up, all of a sudden a Cooper's hawk came through. They had spotted him before I did. And basically one after another was out there, hawk, another one, hawk. And everybody just buried themselves in the thickets and then got down and just froze, hoping that they weren't going to give themselves away. So we also find for chickadees that they have all clear signal when the danger is past. So... there's a real complex kind of vocalization among some of these birds. Some are very simple. Some have much more of a vocabulary or a vocal repertoire.
Yeah, really cool. Bob in Sun Prairie, your turn. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, I got two comments. I was down in Paducah, Kentucky about 10 years ago and walking down the sidewalk of the downtown area, and I could hear somebody's phone ringing. And I thought, whose phone is ringing? And this gal came out of a storefront there and told me it was a mockingbird. And that mockingbird was literally making the exact sound of a telephone ringing.
Thus the name, yes.
Very cool.
Unbelievable. But my other question was, when I travel west on Interstate 80, when I get out in western Nebraska by the Platte River, mm-hmm. I often witness huge migrations of birds. And this last year, it happened to be snow geese, and they were on both sides of the road. I was so amazed. I got off the interstate and took some pictures. And I was wondering, I don't know, how do you estimate how many birds are there?
Okay, I'll take that one first. A couple of ways to be able to count birds. For geese, the problem is when you're looking straight across of them in the field, they're sort of almost on top of each other, so it's hard to separate individuals. When we do our surveys of geese, we do it by airplane. It's easy because you're looking straight down at it. And people have also tried to count shorebird numbers, the sandpipers along the Atlantic coast, for example, when they're stopping over and you get these massive flocks going back and forth. A couple of different ways to do it. Most of it is what we call group counting. So I used to do this at Horicon when we'd see flocks of geese coming in and try to give an estimate. Because I remember people coming, I'm going, oh, gosh, I was here years ago, and I saw so many geese, there must have been millions. It's, well, that's not anywhere near accurate. So for science, we need to be somewhat, have a good guess anyways. And for a group count, what you want to do is, if you count out actual off to the side of a flock, try to count 10 birds or even 25. I like to start with visualizing. I can get a pretty good just visualization of 25 birds by looking at them enough. Mm-hmm. So you go, okay, if that's 25 right there, 50, 75, that's 100. Kind of draw a little circle around that visually. Okay, that's 100, 2, 3, 4, 500 right there. Double that, that's 1,000, 2, 3, 4, 5,000. And you just kind of rough estimate, and it gets you in the ballpark. And remember, when we're talking for science, if we're trying to do population estimates or anything else we're counting in nature, you want to, for statistical significance, be within a 95 percentile. In other words, you want to be within 5%, give or take some. So in other words, when we're talking about a flock of 100,000 Canada geese at Horicon Marsh, I mean, you can be off by 5,000 either way and still be close enough. And it's certainly better than must have been millions. So it is estimates. And another thing that was interesting for shorebirds is I actually saw some videos where they've got flocks of birds going back and forth. They give you 3 to 5 seconds to look at it, and then you type in your numbers. And what they've done is they actually, by using a computer digitally, count the exact number there. And you train your eye to get a little closer and closer to it. One other little aside, a fellow who I used to work with who actually did the Canada Goose counting at Horicon Marsh by plane. These were weekly surveys. He went to the grocery store and he bought himself a bags and bags of little beans. And he had a jar of exactly 1,000 beans. And he would start in fall time and spread those out on the paper. And he'd spread them way out. He'd bunch them real close together. And he just trained his eye to see what does 1,000 look like. When you're 500 feet up, those little geese from there, they look like beans. And at least he had some sort of a visual cue to go by.
Interesting. Very interesting. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking birds and birding with our guest, Bill Volkert. Great to have him back, and thank you for joining in. Vivian in Green Bay called but couldn't stay with us. She's wondering which birds are legal to keep if you find them dead.
The only ones you can actually keep are game birds.
Mm-hmm.
So all birds are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and that was signed between U.S. and Canada in 1917 and 1928 with Mexico. So basically it says that you cannot harm any birds, you cannot possess any wild birds or any part thereof, so you cannot even keep a feather collection. What happens technically is when we have a duck hunting season, they basically put that season in the Federal Registry each year, and in a, as a legal sense, that is an exemption to the Migratory Bird Treaty Act that says that this year, during this period, we can actually shoot and harvest these birds at this rate. Also, turkeys, you'll see quite a bit of the arts and crafts turkey feathers are being used these days because it is a game bird. So, in other words, for mounted birds, if you have a collection of mounted birds, personally, it can only be game birds that have been gotten from the wild. If you have a collector's permit, which is given not to an individual but to an institution, those are museums, schools, nature centers, so they can have hawks, owls, eagles, well, not eagles so much, but different birds like that that they have a special permit for, which allows them as, again, licensed under the federal protection laws. The only other ones that do not fall under that Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and this was, I believe it was in 2006, was Congress passed the Migratory Treaty Reform Act, and that basically said that the non-native birds, the exotics that we have in the United States, are exempt from that. So there were some people who were trying to sue the state of Florida for trying to reduce and get rid of the purple swamp hen, which was brought over from Africa. It was competing with the gallinules down there in the marshes. And finally, Congress said, well, we're not going to protect those birds because they don't belong here in the first place. They were not native birds. So I guess you could, if you want to possess a starling, you could.
So Earl emailed us, 50 years ago, it was common for people to travel hours to see migrating geese at Horicon Refuge. And today, geese are commonplace in many areas throughout the summer. Can you explain the change, Earl wants?
Yeah, well, they've kind of worn out their welcome, I guess. When Canada geese were seen primarily in migration at places like Horicon Marsh in those extraordinary numbers, it was a unique phenomenon. And if anybody has not been there for the late fall migration of geese, it still is a unique phenomenon.
Amazing.
I used to have people come to the marsh going, ah, geese, I'm sick of them. I got that many at home. Well, you're nowhere near what Horicon Marsh will harbor during the peak of the migration. What's really happened is we have two subspecies of the Canada goose. The migratory flock coming from Hudson Bay, James Bay, stopping in Wisconsin, going down towards southern Illinois. That comprises the big migratory flock. And then the birds we see here all summer, which is the giant Canada goose. Their population has been increasing, so we're seeing geese throughout the entire summer period now. And that's why these birds are so widespread. They're causing conflicts, of course, when they're in the city parks and on golf courses, places like that. And so this is what I mean by wearing out their welcome. They're coming into somewhat conflict with people during that summer recreation period. They're trying to raise families in the same places we want to use for our own fun. And so I guess some people just don't see them as quite the unique phenomenon that they used to be. But I can tell you that having worked at Horicon Marsh, when I hear a large flock overhead, it always catches my ear. There's something unique, and it is a real sign of the season.
It is indeed. Amy in Ellison Bay has something kind of relates in a way. Let's go there. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just looking for a little guidance. If I had just one weekend to take a camping trip and I was interested in seeing migrating birds, would you more recommend that I do go to the Horican Marsh or make my way to the Mississippi River, in which case I don't know exactly where to go?
Well, the Mississippi River is a large corridor, and there's only so many public properties and overlooks where you can access the river. And some of those may or may not be large staging areas for the birds. So you can go up and down the river, and some, you know, they're going to be punctuated where the large flocks are going to gather. Horican Marsh is probably a little bit easier because it is one single property. I mean, it is 13 miles long. But, you know, there are a number of great access points and overlooks where you can stand. I'll tell you, for Canada geese, the biggest mistake most people would make is they tend to take their time, show up around 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, hang out, have a little bit of lunch, and then be heading home before dark. And they miss the flock time and again because they come in at sunset. So you want to remain right in that last time from about 4 o'clock till 6 p.m. That's when the big flocks come into the marsh. And we usually reach peak of Canada geese as we get into mid-late October. Right now, ducks are building up in big numbers, and also songbirds are gathering on the marsh.
Yeah, so get over there in the afternoon, and you'll see a lot of birds, mm-hmm. but stay.
Yeah, if you're looking for the geese, for the big migration or the big flights of them, that's at sunset because they're out feeding during the day.
Yeah, there mm-hmm. there you go, Amy. Thank
but there's a lot of other birds to be seen on the marsh. So the ducks remain there, of course, and they're gathered up right now. It puts some good numbers.
Dave in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, I really liked Amy's question. My question is, I wanted to find out about feral cats, what effect they have. And what are the predators for feral cats? I watched a Dirty Job show the other night and showed a group that captures feral cats, neuters them, and then releases them back into the wild. And I wanted to get his opinion on that.
Quick opinion on that, which is capture, neuter, release, bad idea. Sure, you're not going to reproduce, but you still have a predator out there that does not belong here. It is a non-native predator. It is basically, in my mind, an invasive species, especially for ferals, and birds have no defense against that. The Canadian Wildlife Service has actually determined that feral cats, and these are either pets that are left outside or those that are roaming wild, they are the number one human-caused mortality for songbirds in Canada.
Wow.
So it is a significant impact. And the world's just basically getting more dangerous for birds. We're reducing the amount of habitat where they can even live, whether that's where they winter down in the tropics or coming here to nest and raise young. Also in between, the stopover places where they have safe refuge to rest, feed, refuel, and have sufficient food sources for them. That's making the journey harder for them. We've got our tall structures that they fly into, whether that's Chicago last year, the McCormick Center. All of our skyscrapers, buildings are all possible obstructions for these birds, and those are all lethal hazards. Communication towers, our large picture windows, the cats. We're just adding up with more and more things that make it difficult for birds and more challenging for them. So anything we can do to try to reduce that, any one of those impacts is certainly going to help. Because, I mean, these birds have been here with us for so long, and they have a place in nature. Mm-hmm. We've just basically got to give them that place that they need and make it safe for them.
Yeah. And bird strikes on windows, I just see now that they're saying that the mortality is much higher than was originally expected. That it's
well, one of the things that a lot of people tell me is, oh, a bird flew in my window, he didn't kill himself, so I put him in a paper bag, he rested for a little bit, I heard him fluttering, I turned him loose, he flew away, so I think he was okay. The problem is we don't know what sort of internal injuries they may have suffered. So they either fly in and break their neck and die immediately, or they may end up with some internal bleeding and something so they can fly away, but they don't survive. That is probably the easiest thing that we can do to resolve. And I did this at my home. And essentially for songbirds, they try not to fly through anything that is 4 inches apart or less, because they don't think they can fit. And all I did was just get some little adhesive strips, put them on my windows, and that provides a visual barrier. My window strikes went from about 10 or 12 a year to almost absolutely zero. The ones that do hit these days, they're already slowing down and just barely tap it. A lot of things to consider out there for us to help birds.
Bill, thank you so much. We'll look forward to another visit. Bill Volker, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, our guest. Big thanks to our whole team, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our producers, our tech directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots in store here on WPR News.